This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Alethea Kasbin.
It's Sunshine Week in Michigan, and unlike at Sunday's Oscars, there will be no awards this year. The Michigan Press Association says that transparency in Michigan is so bad that they can't award their annual Rep. Peter Battaglia Memorial Sunshine Award to anyone.
So, you know, while it is pretty sunny this week, the Michigan Press Association thinks it's cloudy in Lansing. I will just say I think it's a little odd that this was the year that they didn't award anything for this, because the legislature hasn't done a lot on transparency in previous years when they've given this award. But I also think it sends a message to the Democratic majority. We do expect action from you. And this week, they made good, I think, on that promise, with the Senate taking initial action with bills to expand the Freedom of Information Act to the legislature and governor's office. You know, the Senate taking action on these bills is a pretty big deal. They've been around for a decade, and the Senate has never taken concrete action. There has always been a Senate leader who sort of blocked these bills from moving forward. So the Senate taking the first step, I think, signals this can happen in 2024.
Yeah, this is an issue that has been raised maybe every year, every 2 years, since I started my career at the state capitol. Because, look, Michigan right now is one of just two states that does not subject its legislature and executive office to open records laws. So even with the exceptions or exemptions written into the legislation, including constituent communications, which is pretty broad, this would be a big step. And we spoke with State Senator Jeremy Moss about this issue. Increasing transparency has essentially been his pet project since he first walked into the Capitol of the state legislature a decade ago.
I was a freshman House member in the minority when I started to kind of raise the flag on this issue and found that third term Republican in the majority, Ed McBroom in the House, also had an affinity for this. And we worked together that first term that I served in the House to move these forward, but the Senate never took it up. The next term, we got even more momentum. It actually passed out that second term that I served in the House unanimously. And then the Senate never took it up. So to be able to have Senate action on this piece has been missing over the last 10 years of this effort. And again, you know, I would say, and I think it's fact, that the previous two Senate majority leaders have been the main obstacle to this effort of moving it forward. Now you have a Senate majority leader who really has directed us to get this done. So it's a very big switch or different mode of valuing this project, and I think there's a seriousness that this is hopefully the endeavor that will actually bring this to the finish line.
Right. I mean, I will be one of the first, and certainly not the only ones, to say that these bills are not perfect. But the fact is, right now, journalists and reporters can't submit requests for anything from the legislature or the governor's office. You know, and even with FOIA out there, some lawmakers, you know, are pushing for even more on the transparency front.
Right. So some House Democrats this week also introduced some campaign finance related transparency measures, like requiring lawmakers to register nonprofit funds that right now are kind of murky.
Yeah, this is something Attorney General Dana Nessel has called for recently. You know, right now, lawmakers can create these funds and then put different officers in charge, and their name, you know, just isn't linked to them anywhere. And it can be really difficult to try to figure out who these funds are linked to. Some other things the bills introduced this week would do is require more reporting around gifts and travel that lawmakers can get from either lobbyists or even non-lobbyists.
Obviously, even with all these bills floating around the Capitol, there's still more to do. And we'll dig into some of that more with the rest of our conversation with Senator Moss right after this break.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Alethea Kasbin. Today we are joined by Senator Jeremy Moss. Hello, Senator Moss.
Hey, Alethea, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good. Happy Sunshine Week.
Happy Sunshine Week, although maybe not the happiest of Sunshine Weeks that we have had in a while. It seems like government transparency in Michigan is at an all-time low. There will be no Sunshine Awards. So how do you propose fixing this from sort of the most immediate needs to those pie in the sky needs?
Well, I am previously the two-time Sunshine awardee from the Press Association, so I have credibility in this space. But this week, we are going to make some historic significant movement in the Senate by taking up our FOIA bills in the Senate Oversight Committee and voting them out. And so that is really a signal from our Democratic majority that we are serious about this. Obviously, we've made slow progress over the course of a decade of having these bills introduced to finally include the governor and legislature into the Freedom of Information Act. We've made slow progress getting it out of the House and then finally getting a Senate hearing last term. But we've never really seen this type of demonstration from the leadership level that we're serious about it. And I can tell you, our majority, and working with our minority colleagues as well, are ready to move this forward and finally close out this chapter of darkness over state government and letting in the sunshine.
So I want to get into some of the history of this. So first, I mean, these bills, seeing movement in the Senate, that, you know, is a big deal, right?
Yes. Oh, no question about it. So I was a freshman House member in the minority when I started to kind of raise the flag on this issue and found that third term Republican in the majority, Ed McBroom in the House, also had an affinity for this. And we worked together that first term that I served in the House to move these forward. But the Senate never took it up. The next term, we got even more momentum. It actually passed out that second term that I served in the House unanimously, and then the Senate never took it up. So to be able to have Senate action on this piece has been missing over the last 10 years of this effort. And again, you know, I would say, and I think it's fact, that the previous two Senate majority leaders have been the main obstacle to this effort of moving it forward. Now you have a Senate majority leader who really has directed us to get this done. So it's a very big switch or different mode of valuing this project. And I think there's a seriousness that this is hopefully the endeavor that will actually bring this to the finish line.
You mentioned this is something that you've been working on for almost a decade. And as we all know, the longer things are working on, the more they're tweaked. There's been several different versions. How does the current legislation that you are working on differ from those past versions? What's new? What's different?
Yeah. And so for most part, the main framework remains the same. When we first drafted this, again, you have this 50-year-old Freedom of Information Act. That is the framework from which reporters and citizens alike request information from government, state departments, school districts, county governments, local governments. But the governor's office has been specifically written out and the legislature was never written in. So therefore, there was no ability to request that information. As we began to draft legislation to include the legislature and the governor's office, most of the work really was on the exemptions. How do we protect some of the most sensitive things that we deal with constituents from being requested and perhaps exploited? And so the exemptions have been pretty constant from taking in Governor Snyder's suggestions and then Governor Whitmer's suggestions and then our suggestions as legislators on how to make it work. The biggest difference in this term is the appeals process. So let's say, Shayna, you request something of the legislature and you just don't feel like you're getting all the information or you just got a flat out denial. The previous versions of this draft left that appeals process to stay within the institution of the legislature. We actually made a decision to go beyond that. And if you have a question or you do not agree with how you were given that information, you can actually appeal it to court. And a third party, the judicial branch, will determine the route of your appeal. Just like local units of government, just like counties and other state departments. So we've actually made it better in terms of how somebody can appeal a decision from the legislature on whether or not they accept the result of the FOIA request being fulfilled.
And that was, a significant sticking point in past versions. Those of us who have been covering it for the last decade remember the LORA acronym for the Legislative Open Records Act. That was in the previous version. The idea being, that courts couldn't come in legally wanting to keep, everything constitutional. Sort of what was the evolution in thinking there? Are you confident, that this using the courts to handle appeals will stand up to potential challenges?
Yeah, this was something LORA did a fine job. LORA took us to where we're at today, and we appreciate LORA, but LORA is no more. And so, again, the art of getting this done is getting the votes to get it done. And so we did have some of those within the legislature who expressed these profound constitutional questions. Can the court actually say what the legislature is supposed to reveal? We are an independent branch. We have a speech and debates clause that you cannot sue me in how I speak or debate in carrying out my job as a legislator. And so there were these constitutional questions. Well, then how can the appeals process end up in court? But we made a decision, and we feel comfortable with that decision, that yes, it can fall into court. If the legislature writes a law that says we are subjecting ourselves to judicial review of these appeals, then that is going to be a constitutionally valid approach. This is way in the weeds, and I'm happy to go there. But long story short is, as with any legislative project, you have some people with one theory and you write a bill around that, and then you have an evolution and suddenly that theory just doesn't become as important. What is important here, though, is that this is the strongest version of our FOIA law that we've drafted yet. And I'm hopeful that the people who benefit from the most are the people who are requesting the information from the legislature and governor.
So one of the reasons that you have always taken such an interest in this topic is because you have a journalism degree, you have a history of journalism, and a lot of your fellow legislators, they come from local government where they are absolutely under these open records laws. So why do you think that so many of them get, a kind of heartburn at the thought of subjecting themselves to FOIA?
Yeah, and I say this quite frequently. This is institution-changing stuff. This is culture changing stuff. And so it's all the more difficult to change the way that government operates. If people were elected today and this law was the law of the legislature, they wouldn't think twice about it. But because we are taking a hard line and saying from this day forward, we are going to subject ourselves to an open records law, it's just been difficult to get that process started. So yeah, anybody who comes from local government to the legislature already had to deal with this. And so I think as you're building, county commissioners who became legislators and council members who became legislators and school board members who became legislators, I think you have more people who really understand, okay, it wasn't so onerous on the local level that I served on. And on top of that, the governance can still get done. It's a big change, but that's what we're here to do. We're here to take on these big challenges, regardless of how difficult they may be, because the output isn't going to change the way people receive government services. And in fact, it's going to give them more information how government decisions are made.
So these bills that we're talking about right now expand FOIA. Do you think there's any appetite to get into FOIA and make any changes to the base law that, you know, has applied to all of the other public bodies?
Yeah. And so for the last several years, I've been hearing folks from, you know, variety of interest groups. Well, I didn't like this one thing in FOIA. Or actually, can you change this one? I'm fine with going back into FOIA and reforming some of the things that don't work. This particular project is about putting the legislature and governor into it. I want to get that right first, and then absolutely want to continue, you know, these good government reforms that some people have faced with FOIA's challenges. I know that the fee structure has been incredibly difficult. Sometimes fees are weaponized to prevent information that should be subject, but you charge someone too much and they just can't afford it and they don't get the information anyways. I'm aware of all of the issues with FOIA itself. Let's get the governor and legislature in there and let's let them sit tight, and then let's take on those other challenges as well.
Let's talk about some other issues that are running through the Senate and the state legislature. Recently, the Senate passed a bill to ban firearms at polling locations. What is the thinking there?
So there is no question that Michigan has become one of the states in our country that has continued to receive so much scrutiny and attention and pressure from people who want to wreak havoc in our electoral systems. And so we realize that here in Michigan, there's just a very hot fringe of folks that no matter what happens in the election season, they're going to just be all the more amplified, all the more challenging to deal with. And here in the state of Michigan, if they want to utilize a firearm to carry out their anger, they have the ability to do so. But many other states in our country ban firearms from polling locations. And I'm not talking about, you know, leftist liberal states. I'm talking about Texas, Florida, Mississippi. Those states have made a decision that in the carrying out of our most core democratic process, voting, we shouldn't be allowing people to be armed while, you know, going into this space and really turning up the heat in that manner. So throughout the election process in the legislature, I chair the elections committee in the Senate. The chair of the elections committee in the House, Representative Cerniglo, had a package of bills to ban open carry from polling locations. It's just it's an intimidation display. It makes election workers feel uncomfortable and intimidated. It makes voters feel uncomfortable and intimidated. And if other states have recognized that open carry and the display of firearms really impedes the voting process, surely Michigan can catch up to a state like Texas.
So, you know, banning open carry at polling places is one of the many election law changes that, you know, you guys have made over the course of the last year. You know, now we're, you know, smack dab in the middle of an election year, but are there any other, you know, law changes you're itching to take up right now?
Well, so we've done such an incredible amount of work last year in implementing Proposal 2 to allow for 9 days of early voting. And I think people enjoyed that way to vote in the presidential primary, and they'll have that option for every statewide election. We've made absentee ballot access easier. We've made access to drop boxes easier. We've also refined and shored up some of the challenges in our post-election period, some of the misinformation that was really exploited by bad actors. So we now have a clear line to certification, to sending our Electoral College votes to Congress with no room for any fake slates. So we've done a lot that's prepared ourselves for this year. On the docket this year still is our Michigan Voting Rights Act, which we introduced last year. And we want to give our clerks a chance to catch their breath with all these new reforms. But I do anticipate hearing soon on legislation that is creating the framework to ensure that every voter, every qualified voter has access to their ballot and no mobility issues, no language issues, and other barriers are challenges for people to access their ballot and express their right to vote. We've seen the Federal Voting Rights Act gutted at the federal level. And so we want to really step up here in the state of Michigan to protect voters and their access to their ballot here. So you'll be seeing that hopefully in the next several weeks here in our committee.
We obviously recently had a presidential primary. How do you think the process went for local election officials during that primary? There were some new requirements in place. Do you think it went well? And do you think there are things that need to be ironed out before we get into that higher turnout general election in November?
Yeah. And so I'm a lot of our clerks really appreciated that, you know, they could utilize these new systems as early as our presidential primary, noting that, you know, this November is going to be just a very scrutinized and high turnout election. But I think the overall report card is that it really went well. Voters, I think, really appreciated this 9 days of early voting. And it actually led to these results being able to be reported quicker because more of the vote was in before Election Day. I will also say clerks were very grateful in our most populated communities of our law that gives them the ability to process absentee ballots. I think clerks were also very appreciative of our law that allows them to process absentee ballots before Election Day. We saw a historic amount of absentee ballots used, obviously, during 2020, during the pandemic. But the legislature didn't give clerks any relief to process those ballots before Election Day, which led to, obviously, late reporting of election results as those ballots were continuing to be processed well beyond 8 p.m. on that Tuesday. So now we are taking the lead of some 40 other states, again, red states and blue states, that give their clerks the ability to process those absentee ballots before Election Day. Again, easing the burden of their election administration and lending to accurate results being reported earlier. So this past Election Day, you know, we were not staying up till 4 a.m., you know, waiting for all these counties to report. Many of them, including my home county, Oakland County, I mean, those results were up in the 9 o'clock hour, the bulk of them. And I'm hopeful moving toward August primary and the November election, we are leading the nation in reporting election results and not lagging behind.
Sticking with, you know, this elections theme, there, you know, is a lot of chatter out there that Democrats aren't as enthusiastic around the current president, not as enthusiastic as they've been in previous elections. You know, you recently said that's not what you were hearing and seeing on the ground. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're hearing, you know, from Democratic voters?
Yeah, you know, I'll say this. I think we are romanticizing 2020 a little bit. We all lived through it. In March of 2020, Joe Biden was just clinching the nomination. And really, it was a horse race until the very end of 2020. And so I think we are romanticizing this narrative that we all came together in this kumbaya fashion to defeat Donald Trump, and Joe Biden just was the hero in that moment. Now, I support Joe Biden, and I think he has a lot of good things to run on. But at the same time, you know, I don't uplift him in this way that we are giving all these expectations that he has to fulfill this role where he's the savior once again and everybody's going to come together. It's election season. It's going to go back and forth. It's going to be a horse race. It's going to go down to the very end. But at the same time, I look at 2020. The stakes are high, but the same as 2020, this go around in 2024. The candidates are the same. I expect the same result. I don't see the people who have left Donald Trump in 2020 somehow coming back home to Donald Trump in 2024. So for better or for worse, whether you like it or not, it's a repeat of 2020 here in 2024, and I expect the same result in 2024 as well.
All right. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about the sort of lack of majority that Dems are facing right now, given that there are a couple seats up for grabs in the House. And so things have kind of stalemated a little bit in the legislature. A lot of action in committees, not so much on the House floor. If the Democrats get the majority, what are the plans, you know, come April when they come back and when you guys get that sort of trifecta again?
Yeah. And I think,
what are going to be the big ticket items?
And I think the expectation is that, you know, those two seats are going to remain in Democratic control. These were strong Democratic seats that were vacated due to the mayoral elections and the resignation of the incumbents. I'm mostly expecting we'll head right into the budget. So I know that subcommittees will be continuing to do their work on the appropriations committees. So I anticipate that when we get back to full strength in the House, you'll see a lot of action on the budget in May. Hearkening back to the beginning of this, you know, we got FOIA moving, hopefully from the Senate. I hope that's something that can be a bipartisan win before summer break, given that we can send it over to the House. So some of the projects that we've started in the Senate that are making their way over to the House, I'm hopeful can be picked up. And then I know there's a lot of things that I'm sure that are on queue from House members that they want to be able to send over from the House to the Senate that they just haven't been able to do due to partisan politics over there. So I would say look out for the budget. And whatever we're sending over from the Senate to the House hopefully is on the docket for the House when they're in full strength.
What's the likelihood of that free community college, universal pre-K, and $5,000 family child care credit passing? I know that's one that a lot of people have been interested in.
Yeah, I think that there's discussions about that ongoing right now and figuring out how that works within the budget that we have already established. And so I'm leaving it up to the appropriators to figure all that out. But I know that that is top of mind, and I know that there are major pieces of the governor's proposal that the viability is being challenged or being discussed right now, and trying to set the framework to get it into our budget as we pass it.
Senator Moss, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again to our guest, State Senator Jeremy Moss from Southfield. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with the Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasman. Additional production and editing is done by Hearns Laguerre Jr. Mixing, mastering, and music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this show, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give and becoming a member of WDET at wdet.org.